My name's Don Popejoy, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi, everybody. By God's grace, sponsorship, and the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been sober since the 21st day of February, 1980. My home group is the primary purpose group on Marco Island, Florida. I'm overwhelmed. I'm overwhelmed with gratitude to have been a part of this weekend. I don't think I have the words to express how much I appreciate, how honored and privileged I am to have spent these days here with all of you. I want to thank Mike and the committee for inviting us. I want to thank Eric for being our host and showing us all the grace and courtesy. I want to thank all the speakers. My God, these speakers have just grabbed my heart, and I know that they have yours too, and I want to thank you. Over the years, at times I've had the privilege of serving on conference committees like this, not this large, but like this. So I know something about the commitment and the hours of work and meetings and the effort that goes in to bringing us this kind of a energy-driven, filled, spirit-filled conference. I want to thank all of you on the committee, all of you that have volunteered, all of these 73 groups that have provided our hospitality. I want to thank each and every one of you. And now we're about to wrap this thing up, and it's my responsibility to share with you, in a general way, what I used to be like and what happened to me and what I am like today. And really, my story is the story of all the previous seven speakers. You know, what we've all really heard, me and all of you have heard this weekend from each of these speakers, even though their stories are totally different, we've heard the same message. And what the message is that I've heard is that because of this simple program, the theme of your conference, our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives, and we know this with absolute certainty in a way that is indeed miraculous. And what a glorious message of recovery it's been this weekend. I think all of the speakers have really said, what I used to be like was that there was something missing inside of me. I used to kind of struggle. It was easy for me to tell about what my behavior used to be like, but it was more difficult for me to find words to express to you what I was really like, what I felt like inside. I probably, before I get into this, should clear up a little bit this confusing question of my geography. If you look in your program, it says I'm from Wichita, Kansas. If you read my name badge, it says I'm from Naples, Florida. My home group is on Marco Island, Florida, and we're living today at the Lake of the Ozarks in Missouri. If you're wondering if I know where in the hell I'm from, you got a good question, you know. I got sober in a little town out in southwestern Kansas by the name of Ulysses, and we lived there for a long time. I sold my business in 1996 to some folks in Wichita, and we moved there and lived there for 8 years, and that was our home and my home group. While we were there, we got a little condominium on a lake in the Ozarks, and we'd spend some weekends down there. In December, we made the decision to sell our house in Wichita. I'd quit working at the end of November. We bought a place in Naples, Florida, and moved down there. And then we discovered that summers are not friendly in South Florida because of hurricanes, so we decided we'd keep the place and at the Lake of the Ozarks, and for safety's sake, go up there while the hurricanes are blowing through our new home. So that's the story of my geography. A couple of years ago, Susan had taken some of her girlfriends down to the lake condo to play golf, and after they left, I went down there, and they had obviously put together a jigsaw picture puzzle. It must have rained, so they couldn't play golf. And the very center piece of this puzzle was gone. And I asked Susan, I said, where's the middle of the rest of the puzzle? And she said, the piece in the middle is missing. And I thought, my God, that's what I used to be like. That's exactly what I used to be like. I had this piece missing in the puzzle of my life. The summer between my sophomore and junior year in high school, I kind of went on a quest looking for the missing piece, and I had three first-time experiences that convinced me that I might have found it. In about March of that year, my flight instructor allowed me to fly an airplane by myself for the first time, and as I was cruising around over that flat Kansas countryside and looking at the clouds and the horizon, and I thought, God, it can't get any better than this. This has got to be what I've been missing all my life. And then about the end of the school year, one of the girls in the junior class invited me to go to the junior-senior prom. And my dad let me take his 54 Ford Coupe. And I picked her up and we went to the prom, and she lived out in the country. And sometime between 3 and 5 o'clock in the morning on a dirt road in Grant County, Kansas, in the back seat of my dad's Ford Coupe, I was absolutely certain that I'd found the missing piece in my life. Then sometime in July of that year, my folks were leaving town and going to Colorado fishing, and I asked them if I could use the coupe to take some of my buddies to the drive-in theater. And with some misgivings, he allowed me to do that, and I picked up three of my friends, and we went out, and we were sitting by the drive-in movie, and one of them in the back seat, guess what, it said, guess what I got? And we all said, what? And he said, I got a pint of tequila. Now, the home that I grew up in knew all the agony and the pain and the heartache and the broken promises and the broken hearts of a home with active alcoholism because of my dad's drinking. And I had promised myself as a young boy that I would never drink and that I would never subject the people that I loved and that loved me to the grief of alcoholism that we experienced in our home. And one of these guys took the lid off the bottle, and the first one took a drink and handed it to the guy sitting to the right of me, and he took a drink. And without one single thought of any of that, I put that bottle in my mouth and took the biggest swallow I could take. And I thought I was going to die. It burned and it hurt, and I thought, oh, this is terrible. And I passed it to the back seat. And about 30 seconds later, I had one thought that overpowered every other thought I had for the next 25 years of my life. And that thought was that I hope to God there's some of that stuff left when it gets back around to me. I vaguely remember that night, the rest of that night. When I came to the next morning, I looked out the window of my bedroom and saw that the back end of my dad's car was all bashed in, folded up like an accordion. And when they came home, I started a pattern of my life that was continued till I walked in the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I got drunk. When I drink, the same thing happened over and over again. I drank until there wasn't anything more to drink, until I blacked out or I passed out. I got into trouble, and then I had to lie and cover up my way out of the jam that I was in. And that became the story of my life. For a long time, those experiences that I had as a teenager more or less filled this empty hole in the middle of me. They didn't ever fit quite right. And you know how you do when you're putting together a jigsaw picture puzzle? You find a piece and you think it's right, and you try to push it down in and squeeze it and jam it, and it doesn't quite fit. But you keep working at it because you don't have another piece to put in there yet. And that's the way I was with all these things. Now, I tried all kinds of stuff to fill in the missing piece of my life, not just airplanes and sex and booze. I'd try anything for a while, hoping that maybe it was gonna fill up what was missing in me. I mean, I'm a bar drinker, and I like to drink in bars where the smoke's so thick you can cut it with a knife, and we can hear those ice cubes tinkling in the glasses, where there's a little postage square-sized dance floor in the back of the room. There's a country and western band playing sad music, and people are polishing their belt buckles together. That's my kind of a place. Some of you know about those places. And I'd go to those places, and I'd have these wonderful fantasies about how closing time was going to work out for me. And they never came true. My closing times were a disaster. I mean, the simple truth is, they don't like to go home with guys that are puking on their boots. That's all that there is to it. But I thought, there's got to be something wrong. There's got to be some reason why this isn't working out. Oh, and you need to know one other thing about me. I've been about this bald-headed since I was in my mid-20s. And here it is in the 1970s, I'm a child of the 50s as opposed to a lot of your other speakers who are a child of the 60s, so I vicariously enjoyed their 60s right along with them, though, I'll tell you that. I decided, after giving this matter some thought, that the reason my closing time fantasies were a dismal failure was because I was prematurely bald-headed. And I thought, I need to do something to address this problem. So I lived in this little town of Ulysses out in southwest Kansas, and I heard about a doctor in Wichita. And so I got in my little single-engine airplane and made an appointment with him, and I flew down to Wichita to meet him. I parked in front of a liquor store and a barber shop, walked across the street, walked upstairs to meet this doctor, and he explained to me that for $5,000, he could cut 50 holes in rows in the top of my head. And he could cut 50 plugs of hair out of the back of my neck. And that he could take these plugs of hair and transplant them into these holes that he had cut in the top of my head. And if we got lucky, he could grow me about 10 corn rows of hair. And he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "Not much." He said, "Why?" And I said, "Good grief. $5,000, this is in 1970. I said, $5,000 is a ridiculous amount of money. I'm not into pain. And I looked at him and I said, "And you're more bald-headed than I am. If this works so good, why don't you do it yourself?" I paid him for my appointment, and I walked over to get in my... Well, I first went into the liquor store to get a fifth, because there was one of these, my kind of places, was down... I knew it was down on South Seneca in Wichita. And I looked up, and the easier, softer way just jumped right out and grabbed me. I was parked in front of this barbershop, but it was kind of a specialty barbershop. He had about 10 styrofoam models of men's heads in the window, and on each of these heads there was a full head of hair. It was a man's wig store. And I walked in there and gave him $300 or $400, and I walked out a couple hours later looking exactly like my hero, Glenn Campbell. I had a full head of hair, a pompadour that went from here to here. I was ready to go do the boogaloo. And I got in my car with my fifth of J&B and headed down to the joint and started drinking and listening to the music. And this was a long time ago. But here was the drill. You got the rug and you got the shiny bald head. So the challenge is, how are you going to get the wig to stick on top of the shiny bald head? What they do, they sell you a roll of double-sided adhesive tape. And you cut this tape into little one-inch strips, and you pull the backing off of one side, and you stick that around the inside perimeter of the hairpiece. Then you pull the backing off the other side. Now you got one sticky side down and one sticky side up, and you stick that thing on the top of your head and comb it in, and you're ready to go do it. And I think that works pretty well for non-alcoholic drinkers. I mean, I don't know about you. What happens to me when I drink Mr. Justerini and Brooks Magic Elixir? Some real predictable things are going to happen. I mean, I pour that stuff down my throat, and it burns for a little bit, and then it starts doing its magic. And I become transformed. I morph into another human being. I mean, this guy that was shy and uncomfortable around girls and didn't think he could dance, I'm suddenly the most social giant of the 70s, you know. I can talk, I can do anything, I can dance, and man, in about an hour and a half, that booze starts coming out the top of my head in the form of perspiration. Now, it's a bright audience. Now, adhesive tape abhors perspiration. So, you know, what happened? Here I am. I'm dancing like crazy. I'm drinking that J&B scotch. My head starts to sweat. The tape turns loose and the rug turns around sideways on the top of my head. And it's hard to be a cool operator. It's hard to impress them in a 70s single joint, you know, with the part on your head running from ear to ear. Pompadours hanging down over your right earlobe. The closing time, still a disaster. I parted company with that wig. Two or three years later, I was building an airport in Alamosa, Colorado, and I'd been out drinking. I made it back to the motel room, and this time it hadn't come completely off. One side was still stuck, and it was just hanging over here. I had that half scalp look. Real hip slick and cool, you know. I got it hanging over here. And all of a sudden, it was time for my nightly oblations before the throne of American Standard. I went into the bathroom, got down on my knees, my head went down, the stuff came up, and the other three pieces of tape turned loose, and the rug fell right in there with the rest of it. I might have been accurately labeled as the town drunk, but I sure as hell wasn't the village idiot. I didn't fish it out, you know. I hit the silver handle and waved goodbye to the whole mess. Went to work the next day and said, "Now you've got the real me." Yeah. And I went back to the only thing that really ever almost perfectly filled the hole, and that was booze. Alcohol and alcoholism just put a ring through my nose and took me wherever it wanted to take me. The 25-year progression of active alcoholism in my life, I developed this kind of a credo of living. It said, any means justifies the ends. Whatever I perceived it was that I needed to fill this missing hole inside of me, I went about the business of getting it no matter what the consequences. If I perceived I needed more money to fill up what was missing inside of me, I went about the business of making more money, and I ignored the constraints that were imposed upon the way I'm supposed to do business by the law. I became an ever area of my life, a liar and a cheat and a thief. If I perceived, Susan and I got married in 1960. And if I perceived that I needed more love or sex to make me happy, I went about the business of getting it, ignoring the constraints on my behavior imposed by my marriage vows. And I brought the terrible, crippling affliction of infidelity into our marriage. I became a part-time dad. We had two kids, Steve and Linda. I became an absentee husband and a part-time father. I'd go out and I'd drink all week and I'd come home filled with guilt and shame and remorse and I'd take it out on Susan and the kids and verbal and mental abuse. My dad had died in 1968 and I blamed him for all my troubles. I blamed him for the way that we'd been in our home. My mother lived about 10 minutes away and I didn't speak to her. I guess I blamed her for my dad. I had a brother that worked in this little family construction business, and I thought he was a leech and a drag on my happiness, and I resented him. My life, we've heard these words from speaker after speaker, my life was one of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization by 1980. Susan, in self-preservation mode, had gone to work. And she had a little photography studio in this little town of 3,000 or 4,000 people where we lived. She had a lady working for her named Joyce. I liked Joyce. Her husband John worked with me in this construction, highway construction thing. And we'd get together socially. And Joyce and I'd go out in the kitchen to fix drinks. And we'd have three shooters and make four mixed drinks and take them out and watch John and Susan watch the ice cube melts, and we'd chug ours down and go back in the kitchen and have three shooters and make... She was fun to be around. And then she did the dumbest thing. New Year's Eve, 1979, in an alcoholic blackout, she tried to kill herself. Fortunately, she wasn't successful. But then she did this really ridiculous thing. She started going to this outfit called Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, by this time, I had a little business interest in Denver, Colorado. It's about 300 miles away. And I was running away from home every week to go out there to get drunk and do the things that I do when I get drunk in Denver, to live this Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde kind of life that I know so many of you know about. I'd left to go out there for it. I told Susan I'd be back in a day one time, and I came back a week and a half later and found all my clothes on the front porch. And she said, you either got to go to marriage counseling or you've got to move out. And we didn't want anybody to know there was anything wrong in Camelot, so we'd get on our little airplane every week and fly to Wichita, the other direction, 250 miles, to see this marriage counselor. One day he said to me, does your drinking cause trouble at home? And I said, are you the dumbest counselor in the world? She comes in here and talks to you for an hour every week. You know it causes trouble at home. And I think what he said to me is, then why do you drink? But what I heard him say is, why do you drink at home? And I thought, that's a heck of a good question. I've got this little business in Denver, and I can maybe make it 3 or 4 days in Ulysses without drinking, and then I can fly away and do my drinking and what I do when I drink in Denver. And that was the life that I had in 1980. And I'd gone to work, and the phone rang, and it was Susan, and she said, Joyce and I told her I was going to Denver on business, and she called and said, Joyce and I need to go to Denver with you. We'll meet you at the airport. And I guess, you know, you think about it, the last two people in the world I wanted to go with me to Denver, Colorado, were my wife, for obvious reasons, because I've told you about the kind of life that I lived, and this goofy woman that had just joined Alcoholics Anonymous and wasn't drinking anymore. And I could normally have come up with 10 reasons in 5 seconds why they couldn't go. And I guess this was my first indication that the end was almost near, because I just said, okay, I'll meet you at the airport. And we got in the plane and flew to Denver and checked into a little Holiday Inn where I kept a room. And I don't know what they did. They went off to do whatever they came for, and I went to the bar, and that's the last thing I remember about the 20th day of February of 1980. I woke up the next morning in that hotel room, and I knew where I was because I woke up, I came to there a lot. And then I realized something was really wrong because Susan was there. And I got up, and I still had on the dirty shirt that I had on the day before. And she woke up and ordered some coffee. And I guess she called Joyce's room and asked her to come down and have coffee with us because I'm wearing the clothes I had on the night before, and I've got my arms around this coffee cup, and I'm shaking so bad I can't drink it because the coffee's all pouring down my dirty shirt. And someone knocks on the door, and Susan opens the door, and Joyce comes bounding into the room with her bright, clear little AA eyes, you know. And she says, "Good morning, Don. How are you?" And you've heard other speakers talk about it. Peter talked about it eloquently. And this was my moment of truth. This was my wimpy moment of truth. I said, "Joyce, I'm not worth a damn." And Tammy, I think, last night referred to Wino Joe. Wino Joe's the first AA speaker I ever heard. Wino Joe used to say, "Joyce answered me with these words." She said, "Don, I know how you feel." And Wino Joe used to say the five magic words of Alcoholics Anonymous: "I know how you feel." And I can't believe it. I heard myself saying, "Joyce, would you tell me something about this thing you're doing called Alcoholics Anonymous?" And then what happened, my friends, is that, you see, God not only sent me an angel, he sent her on a cloud because it started snowing right then. And we couldn't fly back. And Susan sat there for the next 24 hours and listened to Joyce tell me about AA, about, we talked about drinking and not drinking. And she shared with me a guy who thought I was doomed. She shared with me that she had found a way up and out. Now, last night at the countdown, when we got to the three-month point, there were still a lot of you out there standing up. And please keep in mind that Joyce had been in Alcoholics Anonymous since January the 1st, and this was the 21st day of February. If someone had to be sober a long time, if someone had to have done all 12 steps, if someone had to know all 12 traditions, if someone had to be able to recite the 12 concepts of service to carry the message of recovery one alcoholic to another in Alcoholics Anonymous, you'd have a different speaker this morning. She'd been through step 5. She knew a little bit about their traditions. She didn't talk much about that. She talked about her experience and her strength and her hope. And I found myself saying, "Would you take me to a meeting of this Alcoholics Anonymous?" I wasn't very sincere about it. I thought it would sound good to Susan, who's... And I thought, well, maybe I might go for a few times and, you know, get the heat off and the screws backed up a little bit and everything will be all right at home. And it quit snowing the next morning, and we flew home. And Susan was starting to speak to me a little bit again, and I thought, this deal's going to pass. It's going to be okay. And we got back, and I was on good behavior, and she'd fixed supper, and I was out in the kitchen helping do the dishes, and the doorbell rang. And it's cold. There's a foot of snow outside. It's middle of February in the High Plains of Kansas. And I opened the door, and there stood Joyce. Joyce is a big, strapping, corn-fed farm girl from Kansas. Tall as me or taller. And she's standing there in her winter coat, and I said, "Hi, Joyce, what are you doing here?" And she said, "Donald, you promised me you'd go with me to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous." And I said, "Well, my God, I didn't mean tonight." It was probably about 5 or 10 degrees, and wind was blowing, and she grabbed me right by the scuff of the shirt and drug me through the front door. And she said, and this she gave me, a loving invitation to Alcoholics Anonymous. Her exact words were, "Get your miserable ass in the car. We're going to hell." I made her drive out in the country and come in the back way. I knew where those idiots met. Oh, the crazy part of this is I've been going back ever since. We walked in the door, and they had a guy there, and he shook my hand. And he said, "The coffee's over there. Get a cup and come sit down by me." And I don't remember much about that first meeting. She came to get me for a week and took me to meetings. And it seemed like right away they started saying, "Well, you need to get a sponsor." And then the next meeting, when they shook my hand, I walk in, they said, "Have you got a sponsor yet?" This is a little town, you know. This is the only group in town. They meet five nights a week, and we're going to all my five meetings because she's coming to get me. And I see this guy in there that I thought, well, I'd always kind of admire him because he was the best bar fighter in Ulysses, Kansas. And I thought, well, I'll ask him to be my sponsor. His name was Louis. So I asked Louis to be my sponsor, and he said, "Yeah, I'd be your sponsor, but you have to agree to do some things." And I said, "What is that?" And he said, "I'm going to give you some assignments to read out of this book that we sold you. And I'll come by and get you, and we'll go to the meeting, and we'll go to the other towns around here to meetings, and we'll go through these assignments, and you have to agree to come to the meetings with me." So I said, "Okay, I'll do that." And he started picking me up, and I mean, I'm getting thrown out of places, you know, in my street life. I'm getting thrown out of good bars and good joints and bad joints, and here this guy, really neat guy, is coming by every night to pick me up and take me to a meeting, and he's giving me these things to read in this blue book. And, of course, what he did right away was he started me on this journey that has just indelibly changed my life. He took me through the steps, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he'd have me read in the book, and then we'd get together and talk about it. He took me through the first three steps, and he'd say, "Don't read ahead, just read the assignment that I give you to read." And I don't like directions like that very good, so I'd always read ahead. And I started reading stuff that really I didn't like at all. And he said, "Don's time now to do the fourth step." So he said, "You need to write your fourth step." Well, by this time it's April, and I said, "Okay, Louis, construction season is getting ready to start, and I get really, really busy in construction season, and we'll have to wait till about next November or December to do the rest of this stuff because I just don't have time." And he came down the next morning to my office, and he threw down a big chief yellow notepad. It's about that thick and about that long, and three number two pencils. And I said, "What's this for?" And he said, "Write until you run out of paper or you run out of pencil lead." He subsequently regretted telling me to write my inventory that way. And I said, "Oh, I just don't have time, Louis." And he said, "Here's the deal, Don." He said, "You're going to get drunk if you don't do the rest of these steps." And he said, "I can't stand the heartbreak seeing you do that." So he said, "Then I want you to ask somebody else to be your sponsor if you can't do this for me." And, man, I mean, a funny thing had happened to me on the way to and from AA. I'd come to want what you had. I didn't want to give up my old life yet. But I'd come to want what you had, and I thought, well, maybe I can do this. So I sat down and I wrote. I didn't write inventory like the book says to write inventory. No, I like the way I write inventory today. I wrote the story of my life. On page 489 in the second edition, in the second edition of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, on page 489, the story's title is called Joe's Woes. Most of us grew up with the third edition and know a different story on page 489. But in the second edition, it's called Joe's Woes, and that's what I wrote. I wrote Don's Woes. I just wrote the immoral litany of my life. He had told me to show up at his house on Tuesday night at 7:30, and we were going to do step five. And I got there, and he did a strange thing. He said, let's get down on our knees, and we got down on our knees and did the third step prayer. And then we got up, and I handed him my inventory, and he handed it back, and he said, you wrote it, you read it. God is listening, and I'm here. And I sat there for the next hour or so. That's why he regretted telling me to do my inventory this way. I sat there for the next hour or so reading him the immoral story of my life. You know, I read to him about my infidelity. I read to him about my lying and cheating and stealing in business, about the illegal business practices that I was involved in. I wrote to him about coming home and being verbally and mentally abusive to Susan and the kids. I wrote to him about how much I was hating my dad and my mom and my brother. I wrote all this stuff, and when I was almost done, he said, Don, stop for a minute. And I looked up, and there were tears running down his face. And I thought, my God, I have so offended him, he's going to ask me to leave. That's what I thought. Because this is the best guy I knew. I'd never known anybody like Louis. The kind of spirituality that I didn't know people had, goodness that I didn't know people had. And he said, my friend, do you realize you're telling me the story of my life? Sometimes we hear people share from these podiums about the sense of freedom they get at the end of step five. What I got was a sense of hope. I thought, my golly, if he could have ever done anything, what I have just read him that I have done, and get from where he is there to where he is now, maybe there's some hope for me. And I went ahead and finished my inventory, and we got down on our knees again, and we did the seven-step prayer. And then he said, we need to see what we can sort out of this mess. And he said, what we're looking for here are your defects of character and who you're angry at and why you're angry at them and what it affects about you. And then we need to take a look at what your part in it is and what part fear has played in it. We need to take a look at your sex life. And I'd written a lot about my sex life. And then because I'd read ahead, I knew in a little bit what he was going to come to. And he said, and then out of all this, we're going to make your amends list. And I said, we got to stop right here. Because I said, I can't clean this deal up. There's no way I can do this. And I wasn't being real honest with my sponsor, because I think more than not thinking I could do it, I wasn't sure that I wanted to do it. I wasn't sure that I wanted to give up the life. What Louis told me was this. He said, Don, if you keep living your life the way you're living it, if you keep violating your marriage vows, if you keep breaking the law in the way you do business, if you keep treating your mom and your brother and all the people that love you the way you're treating them, he said, you haven't got a snowball's chance in hell of staying sober. His sponsor was an ex-professional rodeo cowboy named Jerry. And Jerry used to sit in the meeting and say things like, if you're a drunken horse thief and you decide you want to quit drinking, you're probably also going to have to quit stealing horses. And I didn't know if I wanted to quit stealing the horses in my life. And he said, you can do this, Don. You can. He said, what you got to do is quit doing what you're doing and start doing something else. And he said, the other thing you've got to quit doing is saying, I'm sorry. He said, you are the world's expert at saying, I'm sorry. And cleaning house doesn't have anything to do with saying, I'm sorry. Cleaning house has to do with how can I right the wrong? I'm wrong. I have harmed you. How can I amend the harm? How can I right the wrong? And he sent me home with this long list that we compiled out of that inventory. We talked about what somebody talked about this weekend, Tammy maybe, that we're supposed to go home and take the book down from the shelf and find a quiet place and see if our work is solid so far and see if we've been trying to make mortar without sand and all that good stuff. And that's not exactly what Don did. I went home and wrote a letter of resignation to Alcoholics Anonymous. Louis had convinced Susan and I that we should go to a little AA conference in the Paladura Canyon, south of Amarillo, Texas, called Cedar Glen. And some people in the group had rented a Winnebago, and they were going to come by and pick us up in this Winnebago, and we were going to drive down there. And I thought, what I'll do, we'll take this letter of resignation to Louis at this conference. That would be an appropriate way to resign from Alcoholics Anonymous. So we got down there, and Johnny A. from Laguna was the speaker, and we listened to him. And there's this guy in a group that I knew. He was a few years behind me in school. His name was Bernie. After the meeting, Bernie came up and took me the arm, and he said, "Don, I've got to talk to you." And I said, "Okay." And we went out and sat down under a tree, and I said, "Well, what is it, Bernie?" And he said, "Ever since you walked into the Ulysses group of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've been afraid I'm going to get drunk." And I said, "Oh, my God, why? What have I done to you?" And he said, "No, you don't understand. It's what I have done to you." He said, "I stole something from you that you don't know anything about, and I have to make amends to you for it." And he told me what it was, and I thought it was a pretty trivial deal. And he asked me to set a monetary value on it. And I said, "Bernie, I don't want your money." And he said, "You don't get it, Don." He said, "I've got to do this to stay sober." And so we agreed on something, and he paid me for this little thing he had stolen off of one of our trucks one time. And he got up and left, and I sat there and I thought, "My God, y'all really do the deal. And you do it so that you don't have to drink." See, I'd come to want what you had. I'd come to want, I think Linda talked about it, I'd come to want what I could see inside of you. I didn't know what peace behind eyeballs was like until I sat in a room with you. I didn't know what it was like to be comfortable in your own skin until I got to sit in a room with you. And I wanted that. And I realized, sitting under that tree at Cedar Glen that night, that it all started one day at a time without taking a drink of alcohol. And I thought, well, you know, if Bernie can do this, maybe I can do it too. And I went over to my sponsor's cabin, and I banged on the door, and he let me in, and I said, he said, "What do you want?" And I said, "Well, I came over here with my letter of resignation," and he just went into hysterics. He had an inside groove on this deal. He was also Bernie's sponsor, so he knew what was going on. And he said, "Are you ready to do the deal?" And I said, "Yeah, I guess so." So we took out the list, and he said, "We'll do these one at a time, and I'll tell you how I did mine. And you won't do them until we talk about them." And he said, "We're going to start at home." And I said, "Louis, I read to you all about what it's like in our house." Susan and I met December the 7th, 1958, a day of infamy a few years earlier, Pearl Harbor. We met on a blind date. We were going to Washburn University in Topeka, Kansas, and I had lost a date to the winter formal that I had with this girl because she caught me drunk with another girl in a joint, and she was narrow-minded. And Susan had lost her date because the guy she was going with was flunking, and he got campus for grades. So they fixed us up with this blind date, and I showed up at her house wearing a tuxedo, carrying a ukulele, and singing "Ain't She Sweet." The reason I was singing "Ain't She Sweet" is the only other song I knew the chords to was "My Brother Bill's Got a Still on the Hill," and I didn't think that would be appropriate. We've been on this journey together ever since. We got married, and we went to the service, and we came back, and the alcoholism progressed, and I brought infidelity into our marriage, and she knew it. And I had written to Louis that how bad things were behind the closed door of our bedroom. And Louis said, "Don, it may surprise you to learn that good sex oftentimes begins in the kitchen." And I said, "Louis, there isn't a chance in hell Susan's ever going to go along with that." And he said, that isn't what I mean. He said, you people, he said, you've got to build a new relationship. And I said, Louis, she doesn't trust me. When will she ever trust me? And he said, it'll be some time after you have lived for a period of time trustworthy. Trustworthy. He said, you have to become trustworthy in your behavior. You have to treat her like a loving husband would treat his wife. See, that's, you know, essentially, all you have ever asked me to do in this simple program of Alcoholics Anonymous is, by God, grow up and accept responsibility for your behavior, Don. Grow up. Act like you're a mature adult. Quit acting like a spoiled child. And essentially, that's what it's all boiled down to in my behavior. You asked me to change all of my behavior, but all you asked me to do was act like a grown-up. Act like somebody that had some good sense. And I went to Susan and I told her I'd wronged her and harmed her and asked her what I could do to right the wrong. And she said, don't do it anymore. And suit up and show up around the house here. And Louis said, you got to talk to each other. And I said, we don't talk. We stand in the backyard and scream. We don't want the kids in here are screaming, so we stand in the backyard so the neighbors can hear our screaming. And he read me out of the book where it said, you can't get angry. And he read me out of the book where it says, this is getting serious. Let's talk about it later. And we've used that little simple tool for all these 25 years. And we started to talk, and Susan had started going to Al-Anon by this time. I'd come home from a meeting late one night. She used to sleep on my side of the bed when I wasn't home, so that she'd know when I came home what kind of shape I was in when I'd get home. And I'd been to a meeting, and we'd gone out for a meeting after the meeting, and it was the third step meeting, and I came home, and she was asleep, and I had to wake her up and tell her to scoot over so I could get into bed. She said, where have you been? And I said, I've been to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And she said, well, okay. And I said, you know, I learned the most wonderful thing actually after the meeting tonight. And she kind of woke up, and she said, well, what did you learn? And I said, in my best pontifical voice, I said, I learned that God works through people. And she sat right straight up in bed and said, how long are you going to be going to Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, I think for the rest of my life. And the next morning, she called a lady who had been trying to 12-step her in Al-Anon family groups, and she went to her first Al-Anon meeting that night. And she's been going back ever since. Susan Izzy. Susan is a devoted and committed member of Al-Anon. And my sobriety doesn't depend upon Susan being a member of Al-Anon. The book tells me I've got to burn into my consciousness the idea that I can get sober regardless of anyone, job or no job, wife or no wife, the only requirement being that I trust God and clean house. And I know that's true. But I also know that my life as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous has been immeasurably enhanced because she's a devoted and committed member of Al-Anon. I'd like you to say hello to the love of my life, Susan. And so I made amends to Susan, and I made amends to the kids, and I made amends to my mom, and I made a graveside amends to my dad, and I made amends to my brother. And our daughter Linda Susan accepted my amends, and we started down a road that we're finally, after some period of time of me being trustworthy, we got the ghosts out of the bedroom of our house. Susan talks about when she shares from these podiums that true forgiveness is remembrance without pain. And that's the way it is in our life today. The great miracle of my life is my sobriety as a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. The second great miracle of my life is this relationship that we've built over these last 25 years. And I'm so grateful for both of those miracles. Our son Steve, I need to talk to you a few minutes about Steve. Steve died as a result of drug addiction. He We knew from the time he was in junior high that he had a problem, and we tried to get him help, and he'd get better, and then he'd get worse. Kind of like me and his grandfather, he was kind of a functioning alcoholic. He did well. He went through college, and he went through medical school, and became a medical doctor. And about the time he graduated from medical school, he came to us and told us that we'd gone through a bad period, and he wouldn't talk to me particularly because he blamed me. He never had accepted my amends, although I'd made amends to him twice. And he came to us, and we could tell his attitude had started to change, and he came to us that he'd been going to Alcoholics Anonymous for 6 months. He was 6 months sober, and we were just so thrilled and overjoyed. He had married a wonderful girl, and she was pregnant. He graduated from medical school in June of 1993, and he was dead on the 29th of August. He got accepted to a residency program at Duke University, and they moved down to Durham. And he had a slip on the way down. He called, and I said, "God, the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous are full of people who've had slips, who've come back and put together wonderful lives as recovered alcoholics. Just get a new sponsor and shake the dust off your feet and come back to us." And he did, and he admitted that he'd lied on his medical examination. He got into the impaired physicians program, and he and I were talking on a regular basis, and he seemed to be doing really well. The last time we talked was the week before August the 29th, and he always called on a Sunday, and he called, and Susan had gone to an Al-Anon district meeting. I was the only one there, and he and I talked for the better part of an hour. It was the best conversation I ever had with him in the 29 years I was privileged to know him. And we talked about AA, and he talked about his sponsor, and I talked about my sponsor, and he said, "Dad, when can you come to Durham? I need to make my nine-step amends to you and Mom." And I said, "Well, I just got elected delegate. We've got to go to the state conference, and then we'll come down." And we talked a while, and he said, "I need to tell you something." He said, "I need to tell you that I accept your amends to me." And I said, "Son, I need to tell you before you make amends to me, I accept them." And we told each other that we loved each other and said goodbye, and that's the last conversation we ever had. I thought everything was right in his world. And the next Saturday, we got a call from Kate, and she said, "You got to come down. He didn't show up for grand rounds this morning, and they had to knock the door down into his room, on-call room, and he had apparently written some prescriptions for some powerful synthetic opiates, and he'd stirred up some kind of a cocktail and injected himself, His heart was still beating when they found him, but it was so feeble that his brain was starved for oxygen, and he was brain dead. And we flew down there, and Kate made the decision, and we agreed with it, and to turn off the machines. And Susan and I and Kate and our daughter Linda held Stephen, our arms while the lines went flat on the monitor. And, you know, I have to share this story with you, but I don't share it for the drama of the tragedy. That would be a travesty on Steve's memory, and I would never do that. I share it with you for several reasons. First of all, because brothers and sisters in Alcoholics Anonymous, we suffer from a horrible, ugly, vicious disease. Sometimes I get up here and others get up here and we talk about the goofy, crazy, funny stuff we did when we were drinking. But alcoholism is a terrible illness. It takes our children, it takes our mothers and our fathers. Peter's story. It deprives us of our relationships. It cheats us out of very life itself. And getting here is so important, but we have to do some stuff when we get here. We have to do this deal, and for whatever reason, my son Steve seemed unable to do the deal. Now, because I know that he and I some way are going to connect again in the spiritual world, the AA victory in this story with me and Steve is that when we connect again, we're not going to have to go running up to each other and saying, "I'm so sorry." Hey, because of the house cleaning steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, we got that taken care of. We're okay. We were okay the minute he died, and we're okay right now. And that's AA victory. But God, I don't want anybody. If I could have my will, it would be my will that no parent, no sister, no brother, no son, no daughter, no husband, no wife would ever again have to hold somebody while the lines went flat on the monitor because of alcoholism or drug addiction. And yet we know that sometimes this illness is going to win. And I drove myself crazy for a couple of years with the question, why Steve? I'd go to conferences, and I'd go to particularly to men's conferences, and I'd see all these young men sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I could say, why them, and why not my son Steve? And finally, a few years ago, I was at a men's conference with Big Ed from Iowa, and I don't know what happened that weekend. I guess I just finally surrendered it to God. And, you know, God's God and Don's Don, and it's not my job to know why. It's not my job to know why. It's my only job to do what? To do what? To cherish Steve's memory and to share his tragedy with you in the hopes that maybe that tragedy can be avoided again. And that's why I talk about it. I've had a wonderful relationship with our daughter, Linda. It's always been easier with her. She's married. She doesn't have the illness of alcoholism. I need to talk a little bit about this, my amends, one more thing. Louis had told me that I had to quit being involved in these illegal bidding practices. It was called bid rigging. And I took refuge in the language of the step. It says, except when you do so would injure them or others. And I said, Louis, well, you can't rig a bid by yourself, so... he'd get mad and say, what does the book say? And I said, something about praying for the willingness until it comes. And he said, then I'd start praying about it. Well, by this time I was doing a little bit of praying, and I would sometimes say, God, it'd be nice if you'd show me a way to straighten up this bid rigging thing. And I had quit rigging bids from the time that I did my fifth step. And I got to share with you, be careful what you pray for, no matter how insincerely you pray for it. When I was a year sober, Uncle Sam sent the Justice Department to help me finish step 9. I was indicted for one count of bid rigging, one count of mail fraud. With my sponsor's help, I'd gotten a lawyer, and we went to the government, and I said, this is exactly what I did, and I didn't want to go through the sham of a trial. That would be dishonest. And I said, I want to plead guilty, and you got to draw your own conclusions about other people. And so in 1981, I stood in front of a federal judge in Kansas City, Kansas, and it's still not my favorite place, part of town, and pled guilty to these charges and was sentenced to 6 months in the federal prison at Montgomery, Alabama. And ordered to make restitution. He said, you go sit down with the prosecutors and work out the restitution for my approval. Well, I did, and they came up with this ridiculous amount of money they wanted me to pay back. It was just about to the dollar the amount that Louis had calculated that I had ripped him off. I thought that was interesting. And I learned an important thing about financial amends. They really do want the money back, you know. They gave me 5 years to get that done, and told me that they were going to do a thing called a pre-sentence investigation, and they'd let me know when to show up for prison. And so Susan and I went home and did a real intelligent thing. We started watching late-night movies on TV about life in hard-time prisons. We developed a couple of fears. Susan became fearful they were going to kill me. And I became fearful that something else was going to happen. And I had this AA buddy named Kenneth, and he was an ex-dope dealer, and he was sobered up and studying to get back into college and get a degree in engineering. And I went over to his house one night. I had written inventory about it. I'd shared it with my sponsor. I'd tried to turn it over to God, and this fear that they were going to sexually molest me just gripped my heart till I was powerless over it. And I went over to Kenneth's about 2 o'clock in the morning. I'd woken up and I'd been bawling and I saw his light was on and I banged on the door and he opened the door. It was raining. He said, come in out of the rain. He said, what the hell's the matter with you? I said, Kenneth, I'm going to prison. He said, well, you only got sentenced to 6 months. They're going to let you out. He didn't think 6 months was too big a deal, really. I said, yeah, but you don't understand. He said, I don't understand what. And I said, you don't understand what they're going to do to me. And he looked at me a minute and he said, what do you think they're going to do to you? And I said, oh, my God, Kenny, they're going to rape me. And he wasn't that polite. He just went into roaring laughter about it. And I said, I've just told you my deepest fear in life, and you're laughing at me. And he said, oh, Don Popejoy, your ego knows no bounds. And it went right by me. I didn't get it. I said, what do you mean? And he said, oh, for God's sakes, he said, look at yourself. He said, he said, you're middle-aged, pot-bellied, and bald-headed. He said, baby, you ain't got what they want. And he was right. After I'd served 2 months of that sentence in Montgomery, Maxwell Prison in Montgomery, the judge did something he can't do today because of what my sponsor and his sponsor and people had written about the fact that I quit rigging bids before they ever showed up. He gave me a court order parole after 2 months and several years of probation and sent me back home. And finally, the government let us start bidding on jobs again and doing work. They disbarred us for a while. And I didn't know how I was going to get all this money paid back. And I still don't know exactly what happened, except I did what you told me to do. I suited up and showed up every day. And, you know, a funny thing happened on the way to work, so to speak. I found that when I did that, when I went to work every day and worked all day, I was kind of good at building roads. And I found that I really kind of liked to do it. I'd always thought I'd been trapped into it before, but because my dad had died and I kind of had to do this deal. And I thought, you know, I really like doing this. And I asked the employees if they'd stick it out with me through this period of time. There were at that time about 20, 25 of us, and they did. And in 1985, I gave them a third of this business for their loyalty. And then in 1996, some good people in Wichita, Kansas, asked us if we would like to merge our company with them, and we in effect sold all of our assets to them, and there were about 100 of us by then, and we all walked away with that with some measure of financial security. I worked for these good folks for 5 years for full time, and then the last 4 years part time, and when we retired and we moved to Florida. What a journey you've given me. Out in Ulysses, we didn't have a treatment center. Closest treatment center was a couple hundred miles away. So we had to deal with the doctors, local doctors, that if somebody, some alcoholic was in really bad shape, they put him in the hospital and they would give him the appropriate medications to keep him from going into seizures. And if he and his family would agree to it, members of our AA group would go up from 6 in the evening till 6 in the morning and sit with this guy and do what we could to help the nurses. Actually, what we were doing was making our pitch, of course. And after we did step 5, we were encouraged to put our name on this list. I didn't, so my sponsor did it for me. And Bernie calls me about midnight one night. And he said, Don, there's a guy up in the hospital named Raymond. I need you to go up there from 4 to 6 in the morning. And I said, Bernie, I got to get up and go to work. You know, I said, things are not so great at my store, and I need my sleep. And he said, Don, this is Alcoholics Anonymous. You put your name on the damn list. If you're not going to go, take your name on the list, off the list. And I said, don't make a federal case out of it. I'll go. Bernie's a big guy. So I went up there, and for 2 hours, me and another guy named Jerry sat there, and this Raymond was so pathetic. His liver was the size of 2 footballs. He was wrapped up in a straitjacket. They had him piped a whole bunch of IVs. And for 2 hours, I only did 2 things. I helped Raymond chase imaginary green dogs off his bed because he was having DTs. And he wouldn't use the bedpan, and so we'd have to get him up, and he's dadgum straitjacket with all these IVs and all these trailer things and get him into the bathroom so he could go pee. And he didn't have any aim. And, man, my shoes were wet. The bottoms of my pants were wet. And I couldn't wait to get out of there. And at 6 o'clock, the nurse came and said, okay, you guys can go now. And we tried to talk to Raymond about AA, but we didn't think he heard anything. And I got out in the parking lot, and I opened the door, and I lit a cigarette. And I thought, this is so stupid. I've just spent 2 hours doing the dumbest thing, helping this pathetic character chase green dogs off his bed and go to the bathroom. The last thing I wanted to do. This guy has nothing that he can give me. And this is the very best I've ever felt in my life. I never felt so complete and so whole and so good before. And it was the first time in my life. And I thought, my God, how long has it been since I felt like I wanted to take a drink? And I knew, standing there in that parking lot that morning, that God had come into my life in a way that I didn't think was possible and was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. See, I'd spent all these years trying to stuff the empty hole inside of me with money or love or sex or property or prestige, airplanes. And after 2 hours of doing what AA asked me to do, the last thing that I ever wanted to do, the hole was full. I heard Sandy from Tampa a few years ago say, what if instead of all this stuff that we thought we were trying to find to fill the empty hole, what if what was really wrong with all us alcoholics is that if we were just missing the hell out of God? Think about that, because if that's what's really wrong with me, then it's perfectly clear why this spiritual solution, this simple program, works in my life. God comes in and fills the void in my life. God is what makes me complete. What brings the promise of the 12 and 12 truth? It says the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a group of principles spiritual in their nature, which if practiced as a way of life will expel the obsession to drink. And I knew that was gone and enable the sufferer, me, to become happily and usefully whole. And that's what you do for me, my brothers and sisters of Alcoholics Anonymous. You take me, fractured and broken, and sick, bankrupt spiritually and morally and physically, and you give me this simple program, and it allows me to find God and let God come into my life and do for me what I can't do for myself. And I stay sober one day at a time and become some use to you and my fellow man. That's the miracle of my life. I'm so grateful for it. I'm so grateful for my life, for my sobriety, for my family, and for this unbelievable privilege of sharing it with you this weekend. God bless you till we meet again.